From a sweltering London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 32 for Friday, the 1st of July, 2011. In this week's jam-packed sandwich of mouth-watering news and features, we'll hear from DLD Women Conference in Munich, from which Liv reports about Tesco's ideas for overhauling South Korean grocery shopping. Later, Katie will be sitting down with Peter Head of global engineering firm Arup to see what the future holds for the world's densest cities and to find out what the UK must do to ensure our cities remain sustainable as the resources they currently devour become less plentiful. And poor old social network MySpace, it's finally been given the boot by its parent company News Corp, right as Google announces its intentions to take on Facebook. That's all coming up as we chow down on this week's piping hot dinner of Wired News. Hey there, I'm Nate Langson, I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk, and joining me in the pink trinket cupboard this week is senior staff writer Duncan Gear.
Good afternoon, or morning, or evening, whenever you're listening to this. How are you?
I'm fine. We have no Liv this week because she's over in Munich. She's been at the DLD Women Conference, as I mentioned just a few moments ago. You probably remember that. And in fact, we're going to talk to her before we get to any news about what's been going on at the DLD Women Conference and why is she there? Hey Liv, how is Munich?
Munich is very good. I'm here at the DLD Women's Conference, which is looking at women in business and women and kind of innovation in general.
And you sent me an email with three really, really interesting things in which I want to go over. The first is, I know you're seeing quite a lot of startups. What have been the most interesting business ideas that you've seen so far out there?
Well, one of them is a kind of interesting initiative by Tesco's equivalent in South Korea, which is called Home Plus. It's actually their branch and their what they themselves in South Korea, and they were trying to find a way to drive their sales without having to open any more stores. So what they did is they came up with a great idea to target commuters on the platform when they're waiting for their trains in the evening. And so what they did was they plastered the walls of the whole platform of the metro with pictures of the stock of their stores looking like they're on the actual shelves in the aisle. And the idea is to make this so you could have a look at all these items, then use a QR code to add that item directly to your online shopping basket on your mobile phone. And so you could do your shopping while you're just waiting for the metro and get it delivered a few hours later, which is pretty cool.
This is like one of the first and only examples of QR codes being used for something that isn't fundamentally pointless.
Oh, well, exactly. I mean, QR codes I generally think are pretty rubbish, but I think in South Korea and in Japan, they're much more widely used because they have more kind of standardization through on their handsets.
I know there was a really interesting video that they showed at the conference, which we've got embedded in the story you wrote for Wired today. And I just want to play a little clip from it because I found it an amazingly sort of almost patronizing way of describing the South Korean people. So let's have a quick listen to this.
We made an in-depth study into Koreans once more. Koreans are the second most hardworking people in the world. For them, grocery shopping once a week is a dreaded task. So we decided to approach these busy and tired people.
Cool, so they're really aiming just to make shopping faster at a time where people haven't really got time to go to the shops, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's a dead time, and it's also about making kind of online shopping a bit more discoverable. I mean, normally when you shop online, you have a shopping list, and you don't really deviate from that. You might just repeat it, but this way you have that kind of discoverability of walking through a supermarket and spying stuff on the shelf.
Cool. So one of the other things you saw was to do with sort of online fashion shopping for the lazy and bone idle.
Yeah, right? Exactly. This is a website called Stylist Pick. And what it is, it's a kind of curated fashion subscription website. So it's for people who are kind of too busy even to browse online. I guess that's pretty busy or pretty lazy. And what you do is you pay a subscription per month, and you get and you fill out a questionnaire based on your style preferences. And then every month they'll send you six potential items that are in fashion, on trend, whatever. And then you pick one of them. And if you don't want one of them, you can skip a month and get to the next month. But the idea is that you kind of someone delivers you a very limited selection which they think you'll already like, and you get to pick based on that.
So it's a little bit almost like a cross between boo.com of the dot-com boom and Amazon's kind of you bought
this, you may also be interested in this. I wonder how that would work, sort of, you have bought shoes, you may also be interested in socks.
Yeah, I think it's a bit more sophisticated than that. But I think it's this idea of curated e-commerce experiences. Instead of going for we have everything available, which obviously Amazon does, it's about saying, okay, you don't want to see everything. You want to see a select number of items which we already have decided you might like.
And is this site live now? Can people browse it in the UK?
It is, yeah. You can just go to www.stylistpick.com and it's live.
Okay, and what's obviously you've seen tons and tons of stuff. What's been the most bizarre or unusual thing that you've seen out there?
Right. Well, without a doubt, the most bizarre thing, it was during a speech by Mel Rosenberg, who is a microbiologist, but also jazz singer. So first of all, he sang on stage before he did his presentation, which was pretty unusual. And secondly, he was talking about the kind of science of perfume. And one of the things that he revealed, which I did not know, and perhaps some of our listeners will know, was that many perfumes actually contain these compounds called indolet and skatol. Is that right? But these are compounds that naturally occur in feces, as in poo in perfume. They're compounds which are in nearly every perfume that you'll buy.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's in addition to the sex organs of plants and the musks from animals, which is, I mean, obviously they're now often recreated synthetically, but, you know, musk and is something that's emitted by animals to attract mates.
Interesting. Well, we've got a number of stories on the site, I think, certainly already about Tesco, and looking forward to seeing what else you come up with before you leave Munich.
No doubt there'll be a lot. There's going to be a great jam-packed afternoon ahead of me, so I'm looking forward to it.
Cool. Thanks, Liv. If anyone hasn't seen the video that we played a clip from in that interview, you should go to wire.co.uk and search for Tesco South Korea. You'll find it. It's the weirdest thing to see. It's kind of like walls in South Korean train stations and have massive posters put up on them of whatever a supermarket has in stock. And then a load of busy people going, taking photos of like the QR codes so they can order tomato sauce to be at home when they get there. It's crazy.
It's a really cool concept. I don't know what they do, though, when something runs out. What happens if something goes out of stock?
New poster. Yep. Or a recommended alternative, which I had once when I ordered from Tesco. They ran out of conditioner, so they replaced it with more shampoo.
That's not much use, is it?
It's useless. We're going to talk now about Google. Duncan, tell me about Google Plus, actually.
Google Plus is Google's latest foray into the world of social networking. They have, for most of this year, it seems, and we'll come onto that in a minute, been working on adding social aspects to all of their services, and tying it all together is Google Plus.
And Google Plus has sort of a number of different components. The most important one, I think, is something called Circles, right?
Yeah, it's about putting people in social groups. And in the real world, you may have, several of these overlapping social groups where your co-workers will be in one, but some of your co-workers might know some of your friends, which are in another group, and then you've got your school friends and maybe some people you're in a band with, and you want to communicate in different ways to different people. And Circles lets you do that in a very similar way to how Facebook Groups does it, but Facebook Groups never really took off particularly.
Yeah, I've got one list on Facebook called Best Friends. Half of them are enemies now, to be perfectly honest.
Do you make enemies quite fast?
Oh, yeah.
And Circles is interesting because you can, as I say, a person can be a member of more than one group. So you can kind of almost visualize in your head all of these overlapping circles with different people inside.
So let's take this from the top. You've got a whole load of friends on Google Plus, and then you have maybe six circles. One is family, but one of your family members may also, let's say, be a colleague. Perhaps. And they could be in both circles. And if you share a load of stuff with your colleagues, it's going to go to that person who's also a member of family.
Yeah. Or for another example, you could have a bunch of friends in your industry, and then there's people in your industry that you don't know so well, and then so there's colleagues, and some of those might be your friends. And it just lets you overlap and share things in different ways with different people. That's what's integral to it.
Okay. And then there's something else as well, Hangouts, which is something you can do with the people that you put into these circles, which is kind of like group video chat.
Yeah, not just video, but it lets you spend time online with people in the same way you might in a small chat room if you'd set one up for a group of friends. It lets you use video cameras or text to interact with each other, and you can even do things together like watching a YouTube video. And what particularly excites me with that is is Google's plans. Well, they haven't announced them officially as plans, but certainly ambitions to move into movie rentals. And I just love the idea of sitting down with five people in different houses and watching a movie together.
And you can all sort of type and text together like you were in the same room, only you're not.
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's
why wouldn't you just invite them round? Send them all a message and say, come round to my house. I'm watching a movie. I've got popcorn.
They might not be able to. They might be in different countries. They might have other stuff that they have to do. But, I mean, you could, for example, set up a circle of people who really like Deal or No Deal and then watch Deal or No Deal episodes things together, on Hangouts together.
I see where you're going with this. It's because I like Deal or No Deal, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Going in my enemy's circle now. Thanks.
Oh, great.
Yeah, okay. Sorry, I interrupted you. You were about to say something that wasn't facetious and pointless.
I was going to talk about Sparks, which is the third interesting bit about Google+. Sparks is, well, it's probably the vaguest of all the aspects of it. Google presents it as a way to share content, all types of content, articles, videos, images, you know, all kinds of stuff with the people in your various different circles. But it also suggests that they will deliver content personalized to you, stuff that you might like already. And it's not entirely clear how they'll do that, presumably based on your browsing behavior.
So I guess from what I'm getting from this is that Google Sparks is a bit like your Facebook news feed combined with your Twitter feed, perhaps, with, you know,
Google Reader. Yeah, it's a way of delivering you interesting content that it thinks that you'll like, that is affected by what your friends are doing and what you're doing.
Hmm. So you've got all these news and interesting things recommendation service, Google Sparks. You've got Google Hangouts, where you can sort of chat and share things with your friends in real time with video, with text and things. And they're all pulled together under Circles, which in turn is all pulled together under Google Plus.
Yes.
And that's the new network.
Yes.
And do you think this is something that's actually going to take on Facebook? Because typically things fail and social things fail until there's a critical mass.
Yep.
You need all of your friends to be on one of these networks in order for it to work. And in the past, MySpace stole things from Friendster because all the friends started moving to MySpace. So you want to be where your friends are, so you leave Friendster and you go to that. And then everyone left that to go to Facebook. Is this going to happen? Are you going to leave Facebook once all of your friends get on Google Plus?
No. Well, no. I won't leave Facebook until Facebook becomes useless to me. In the same way that I didn't leave MySpace for a long time because I was still using it for certain things. And when I stopped using it for those things, then it was useless to me and I left. I think you're absolutely right that it takes a tipping point, a critical mass, until a social service becomes useful. And by operating under what is currently an invite-only policy, Google is artificially limiting how useful its service can be, which is an odd move if you ask me.
Facebook as well has become more than a social network now. It is basically like something, I like to call it a meta web, where it's kind of like an entire web sitting on top of the web. You have in its own walled garden that does kind of filter into other sites for things like commenting. But really, you go on Facebook, not only are all your friends there, but your favorite brands are feeding into your newsfeed. You can interact with them. You've got your event invites. It's your calendar. It's this entire web sitting on top of the rest of the web. And so it almost feels like Google Plus could almost replace the social aspect of Facebook, and Facebook remains this entire network of information for things that aren't just your friends.
Well, I think definitely that's Facebook's Achilles heel, the fact that it's this walled garden. Google has said, or in fact, Google lets you export all of your data in handy files out of its Plus service whenever you want to. Facebook doesn't offer such an easy option to its users.
So when is Google going to be offering this new service to its users?
Well, it's available now if you've had an invite. So if you can procure yourself one of those, then you're in.
Alice, our intern, has had one.
Ah, well, that's good.
Yeah, she's going on my list of enemies straight away because she didn't give me an invite from her account.
I wouldn't be that bothered if I were you, because it won't be useful until everybody's on there.
And what's really bad about this, or really good, depending on which side of the fence you're sitting on, is that this has all come about the same week that News Corp has announced that it has sold MySpace. Now, News Corp, is a bit of background, bought MySpace in 2005 for just under $600 million. And although the price isn't public yet for how much it sold MySpace for this week, we think it's between $30 and $40 million. So we're talking more than 10 times less than it acquired
it's
it
about
for 6 years.
7/100ths of the amount?
It's pretty bad. Obviously, I don't think we need to go into why MySpace has tanked, but everyone's on Facebook now. And it's been sold to Specific Media, which is a media firm founded about 12 years ago. And Justin Timberlake is going to be taking an ownership stake and is going to be on board with guiding the business. Now, it's easy to laugh because he's a pop star or an actor or whatever you want to call him. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he doesn't have some cool ideas for how to take a fairly music and media focused website with, you know, still quite a few million people obviously using it and turning it into something that could be maybe useful from a very different angle.
What MySpace does have, and this is, I think, it's by far its greatest asset, is an enormous, enormous catalogue of music that bands have uploaded to it. And it's also got, you know, years and years of goodwill with the major record labels. I think if MySpace pivoted into some kind of streaming service, that could be an incredibly powerful and formidable thing if they did it right, if they executed that right.
Wrapping up with the Google stuff as well, I mean, Google's putting such a huge emphasis on making social work at this point that apparently 25% of every Google employee's bonus this year will be tied directly to how well Google's social projects work. So if Google succeeds in social networking in the way it wants to, you'll get a 25% higher bonus. If it fails, you'll get 25% less. And that's for every employee in Google, apparently. So,
yeah, I hope it works because Facebook needs some competition. I really hope that they can do something that is really, really... what's the word I'm looking
influential.
For?
Influential.
Influential, yeah.
Game-changing, so. Paradigm-shifting.
All of those things and more. But I want them to do it. I want them to do it. I want them to do it really, really well so that Facebook has to up its game. More competition is good.
It's just a shame it didn't work out for MySpace. Oh, well, maybe it will now they've got a new owner. Let's move on from social networking to health. The NHS is putting all of your records in the cloud on the internet.
Well, not all of them and not mine, but...
it may have been a small exaggeration.
It's piloting a project to put patient health records in the cloud so that you can access them from anywhere, on any device, and have a lot more control over who gets to access them.
And this isn't happening at every hospital. The NHS is piloting it, but it's at a small number of places, right?
It's at one place. It's at the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital in London. They're developing a pilot with Edinburgh Napier University and a Scottish company called Flexient.
One of the guys actually from Flexient, Tony Lucas, said that this project could be used to integrate all phases of healthcare treatment from assisting living to primary and secondary healthcare so that the same data can be used throughout. You know, you can pass your data from, say, a specialist to a carer to a hospital to outpatient center, something like that.
It's interesting timing.
It's very interesting timing because Google just closed down Google Health. Not to talk more about Google, but Google had this Health Vault service where users in the US could store their medical records securely and make it easier to move them from, say, one hospital to the next or to any institution that was using Google Health as well.
Which is a bigger deal in the States because obviously not all the hospitals are owned by one single body.
That's right. And this week, just as this was announced, Google said, we're killing Google Health. But there's a big difference because one was a commercial project, Google Health, but this is an NHS thing.
Yeah, and so it's not quite as for-profit in the same way. It's also interesting timing because we're in the midst of one of the largest hacking epidemics that that we've ever seen. And there's big questions about security of your health records because they're one of the most private and personal things available to you.
They are. So how exactly are they going to work out whether this is going to stay secure?
Well, they are, for the very first phase of the pilot, they're going to be using simulated records rather than the real thing. I'm not sure about what happens later on, but they've been talking about incorporating multiple methods for identifying who's logging in to view your data in the same way that you have several things that you have to do to get access to your bank account. That should hopefully provide a bit of extra security.
Well, until I know more about this, I can't honestly say that I am sort of chomping at the bit to give all my medical data and put it into the cloud. But
I'm quite curious to see what data they've got on me.
Really? You can find out.
Yeah, I know I can, but I haven't. But
request it.
Yeah, because I've got to go down to my local GP or whatever, and he'll probably have to phone up a bunch of hospitals or whatever. But if all of this stuff is in one place and I can just log onto the internet and see it, that would be awesome.
It's an interesting trend. When's the pilot going to launch?
The pilot is launching, by the time you're listening to it, this month, July 2011. So keep your ears and eyes peeled for that one.
Sehr interessant, Duncan. Well, from health to bombs, and more specifically what you can do to make sure that you don't die as a result of a bomb exploding, there is some interesting work going on, Duncan, with in-flight protection against bombs.
This is some research going on at Sheffield University where they're testing a bomb-proof baggage hold.
It's called Flybag.
Yes, and it's designed to contain a passenger aircraft in the cargo hold of the aeroplane while it's in flight. It's made up of several different layers of fabrics and composites, but the key bit is this... An internal coating where the fabric has been saturated with sheer thickening fluid.
Okay, now this is the fabric that's basically going around the inside of the cargo hold in a plane.
Yes. Well, I think probably what will happen is they'll put the bags into other bag, like a big extra bag, and then put that extra bag into the cargo hold.
So if there's a bomb in one of these bags, it'll explode and it won't take the plane down.
That's the idea.
And how? How does this work?
Well, as I was saying, one of the fabrics that makes up the bag is saturated with sheer thickening fluid, which is a fluid that normally behaves like a liquid, but if it's hit with a certain amount of force, it will harden and behave like a solid. You might have seen people on TV running along rivers of what looks like liquid, but by the force of their heels, they can actually, it acts as a solid.
I've seen that actually, yeah. It kind of looks a bit like custard.
Yeah, you can do it with corn flour. You can do it, if you get the proportions right with corn flour in water, you can actually roll it up into a ball and then bounce it off a hard surface, but then it will splat out onto the floor again.
Hang about. Is this the stuff that was in Stretch Armstrong?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
The stretchy dude that you had as a kid?
Yeah, where you pulled his arms out. Yeah, I think he was full of corn flour.
I always knew he was going to prevent me from dying in a bomb explosion. Wow. I just knew it.
Now he is.
I just knew it.
But yeah, they've built a prototype that has managed to withstand the impact of a bomb about the same size as the Lockerbie bomb that brought down Pan Am Flight 103 in 1988.
And when might we get this technology?
Well, that's a good question. They've built this prototype, and one of their researchers, Jim Warren, said that the bag is showing no signs of failing yet. We keep putting bombs in it and bigger ones until something fails, and then we can say this design is good up to that level. So it sounds like it's going fairly well.
Other things that are going to go incredibly well is the quick break. But don't worry, we're going to come back. And when we do, we're going to talk about a new trend we're seeing in the games industry, which could see your favourite titles go free.
Wired magazine, now published digitally every month on iPad. Download the latest interactive issue, available now on the iTunes App Store.
Duncan, I like stuff that's free. I have to be honest.
What's your favourite free thing?
Oxygen.
Oxygen.
Yeah, it's not a game though. Tell me about this new trend that I keep hearing is the next best thing in the world of things that are free.
This is something that's becoming increasingly more common in the games industry, where developers will put out their titles for absolutely no cost, but then make money off it by selling tiny little things within the game that make it a more fun experience to play.
And the massive game World of Warcraft that has been around for years is one of these titles that's going free.
Sort of. You play the first 20 levels completely free, infinite trial, but then there's a bunch of restrictions on that. You can't use auction houses or trade skills are capped. You can't collect very much gold.
So why is a company that has made loads and loads of money, I mean Blizzard, Activision does World of Warcraft, huge developer, publisher. Why have they decided to make this incredibly profitable game free for a while?
It's all about giving people a little taste and hoping they get hooked. And once they get hooked, they're much, much more willing to cough up the £10 a month subscription fee that it costs to play World of Warcraft.
Are you saying that the games industry is taking a tip from the drugs trade?
No.
Because I'm fairly sure that's how crack works. You get a bit for free, and then when you're suckered in, you get charged a lot of money.
Well, there's other games as well that are taking a very different approach to free-to-play that I guess kind of reflects more the general trend in the industry. What they're doing is they're making the game entirely free-to-play, limitless and fun, completely free, but then offering little perks that you can pay for. So you might get a bonus experience or something like that. Or if you have to wait 3 hours for, I don't know, a house to build, you can pay, I don't know, just a tiny amount of money, 5p, 10p, and it will complete instantly.
Recently, I've been getting incredibly annoyed, as regular listeners will know, about online passes, where you pay for a game and then you have to pay another £10 or something just to play the game that you've just paid for online. This, to me, just seems like an extension of that.
Well, it's the thing is, the difference is you don't pay in the first place. You get a free game, and then if you want to play online, then you pay. Is that not a bit more fair?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I just wanted to be controversial and just argue.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
okay.
But I completely agree. The difference
you're
there,
going in my enemy's circle now.
Okay, well, we can be friends in hate. It's not a new trend, though, but it's one that's growing much faster now. Dungeons & Dragons, I think, went free to play in 2009, so they were ahead of this trend.
Yeah, and in the Far East, for a long time, there have been games that have been operating this way because there have been these massive, massive, great big problems with piracy there, and free-to-play is a wonderful way around that problem.
So is this whole thing, it looks like a great consumer-friendly way of, you know, getting people to try games like they were drugs, but really what it is as a way of getting more money out of people who are pirating it.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it kind of reduces the value of piracy because you're pirating something that you get free anyway, and there's no real way of pirating the additional extras that you pay for because you have to have an account and log in and you're verified and all that kind of thing. What's really interesting is seeing this trend from the Far East suddenly take over in the West in such a big way.
It's absolutely a trend to keep your eye on if you're interested in the world of gaming and how it's evolving in this world we live in that's full of freeloaders.
I thought you were going to try and attempt to segue into our next link, and I was like wondering, how on earth are you going to do that?
Challenge accepted. Things that are also free are skulls, which some people use to bash into other people's skulls. And there has recently been a discovery that a 72-million-year-old leaf-eating dinosaur called Stegosaurus would outclass any other modern-day headbutter.
Yeah, not Stegosaurus, we should add here. This is a completely different dinosaur called Stegosaurus, which is much shorter, much tinier. It's a little diddy thing, but it has a very, very, very impressive talent for headbutting.
Past tense. And the reason that this is in the lineup is because I love the idea of dinosaur news. Tell me more about this anyway, Duncan.
Animals who are quite keen on butting heads with each other have built up some kind of resistance to that over the years. They've evolved a stiff bit on the outside of their skull with an energy-absorbing material beneath it so that it doesn't hurt them too much and stops them knocking themselves out, like giraffes sometimes do when they hit their heads together.
And the news here is that this incredibly old dinosaur would have basically been able to headbutt any modern-day creature to death with its head.
Yeah, basically, it had an extra layer of really, really dense bone in the middle of the spongy energy-absorbing material, which would give it a much, much more formidable headbutt than, I don't know, a bull or something like that.
I would love to see Walking with Dinosaurs bring this creature into the world and have it, like, headbutt a horse.
Well, it probably wouldn't be able to reach, because the dinosaur in question, Stegosaurus, was only about the size of a German Shepherd dog.
Oh.
So
it's small and tough.
Yeah, it could have headbutt a Labrador.
It's time to move on to something a little more down to earth. Katie has spoken to Peter Head from the engineering firm Arup, which designed the amazing Manchester Stadium. It was involved in designing Heathrow Terminal 5 and the London Gherkin, which anyone who's watched The Apprentice will obviously be very familiar with. And what we wanted to know from Peter was, what's the future of cities and where will we be living in the future? How will we be living? And how will responsible design make all this happen?
This is Katie from wired.co.uk, and I'm speaking to Peter Head from Arup about his company's vision of where and how we'll be living in the future. Thanks for joining me, Peter. Having large swathes of green space would have a huge impact on the environment, but how could you create such areas in cities like London, where buildings are so tightly packed together?
Well, one of the features of this is to introduce urban agriculture, both into ground level and rooftops and so on. So actually there is a sort of merging of agricultural activity between the areas outside the city and inside. And if both of those share treated wastewater and composting and nutrients coming from waste, then actually one can actually both increase ecology but also increase the amount of greenness. And by combining that with things like planting trees in streets and having swales where the water soaks into the soil rather than being carried away in drains and things, you can actually increase the ecology and make it a more attractive place to live, as well as a more productive place, actually, in terms of jobs and local food growing.
In the proposal, you describe this as retrofitting existing cities for a low-carbon future.
Yes, we do. Retrofitting isn't a very elegant word, I think, for what it is, because, of course, it is actually a way of working with the community to refashion their community so it's more sustainable. So there are more local jobs, mobility is easier, maybe you can get around and do several things at once, have shared services within the community. So it's a lot more than just, introducing green spaces. It's a way of actually, for example, maybe closing some streets to enable children to walk and cycle to school when it wouldn't have been safe otherwise, as well as having more access to green space and a more attractive place. So it's a combination of energy efficiency, water efficiency, waste management, mobility, and community interest change, really, and neighbourhood planning, you might call it.
It's so much more than combining architecture, economics and environmental awareness, then. It's an actual wholesale change in thinking.
Yes, it is. And in the UK, we have a new localism bill which is going through our parliament, and that will facilitate neighbourhood planning of this kind, which can, as you quite rightly say, bring in all these different elements of thinking. And with our sort of increasing knowledge of how we can be more sustainable which basically for me means that families have lower costs for many of the way they run their family life, it hopefully will be helpful in terms of budgeting and so on and help sort of mitigate against increasing fossil fuel costs and oil costs.
One of the proposals within the scheme is to raise carbon prices and penalise households for wastage. Can you tell us more about how this would be done?
I think the world basically needs a higher carbon price. And of course, we don't know how to achieve it yet. But in principle, the world needs a higher carbon price so that we actually stop polluting the planet and creating global warming, which in turn will, you know, be very destructive and disruptive to the economy. But at a local level, I believe we need a combination of that, which is something that governments have to really organise, but also helping people to be able to live with much less cost in terms of the actual resources they use. Because even if the unit price is a bit higher, if you can live without so much of it, it can still be cheaper. So in my view, the cheapness can overcome the extra cost, which I suppose might come through in taxes.
Are there any schemes based upon these proposals actually planned at the moment or going ahead?
Well, we're certainly working on the development of schemes in the UK now. We helped to create an organisation called the Institute for Sustainability, which has its own website. And they are working with communities in East London to develop demonstrator projects of this kind. In the end, I think, you know, there are many, many neighbourhood planning projects going on in the UK, but at the sort of scale we think you need to implement it, which is at least 20,000 homes with a sort of street-by-street change. The only project that I know of is this one that we're planning to do in East London.
Lastly, if people don't take heed and make changes, what will our cities look like in 10 to 15 years' time?
Well, I think there's sort of two directions to go in. I think if we keep going with this sort of idea of growth, certainly in big cities, if we just keep the idea that, you know, growth is everything, more population, more infrastructure, more investment, it really is a sort of unsustainable direction in terms of sucking in more and more need to more and more resources. So I think basically the process of change that we need to take is one of this sort of spending money more on retrofit and improving the, if you like, the internal efficiency of cities, so that actually people in neighbourhoods can live more happily and at lower cost. And I think that's probably the direction we go in. So hopefully as that progresses, cities become greener, the availability of walking and cycling and public transport and local food is greater, and people are able to use shared services, applications on their mobile phones that help them to find cheap local services and ways of travelling around more efficiently. I think that's the sort of direction that we will find people will be able to follow in 10 to 15.
Well, thank you ever so much for sharing your vision of the future with us, Peter, and keep us posted as to developments in the UK.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Amazing. Thank you, Katie. Thank you, Peter. And that is the end of our show for this week. Let's give some stuff away. We've got an iPad 2 to give away on Facebook as part of our inevitable Robot Uprising competition.
Should we explain this one a little bit?
No, I think that's enough.
This is a tag I started putting on stories on the site a while back where it had some relevance to robots taking over the world. And we added it to more and more stories. And so now what we want to know from you is when the inevitable robot uprising occurs, will you support it or will you oppose it?
And if you can convince us that you have the most compelling argument for either rebelling or just getting on with it and saying, whatever, you're probably better than us anyway, then you could win an iPad.
So what you need to do to enter is go to our Wired UK Facebook page, which is facebook.com/WiredUK. Scroll down a bit on the wall and you'll see a link to a post called The Inevitable Robot Uprising. There'll be two pictures. There's one that supports it and one that opposes it. Pick your side, post your description in the comment of the picture, not of the wall post, and you'll be entered.
Obviously, our Facebook wall is the place for you to leave us some feedback, but you can also email us, podcast@wired.co.uk. We await your feedback, comments, criticism, and praise with bated breath.
Or you can harangue us on Twitter, as so many people do. We are at Wired UK on Twitter. Nate is at Nate Langson. I'm at Duncan Gear. Liv, who is in Munich this week, is at Olivia_Solon. And Katie Scott is at KatieScott1980.
And I am on time to go and get some coffee, so we will see you again next week.
Have a lovely week. I asked her if she had any sausage, and she said she hadn't had a single sausage.